This country was created with corporate charters. All Virginia, New England, even the Hudson Bay. Chartered corporations brought the slaves to labor. Chartered corporations rule the world today.
All blessings flow.
With the rights of a real person,
it is eternal. Bow low.
When that someone getting rich is we.
We, oh bountiful earth, we're using you up. We, we're drinking dry the overflowing cup. And that is the way that it must be. For it is we, who are the end.
We open this program with the profane litany of the Mammon Tabernacle Choir. We think it a fine and fitting overture to our subject today, that mystical body of Fortune 500 theology, the corporate person, a hairless, heartless, and ruthless entity that judge-made law has endowed with superhuman powers, an eternal, insatiable life. I am your usher, David Kubiak, here to introduce you to this bizarre being. We think it's about time you, and all other Americans, finally make its unnerving acquaintance, because your children, our democracy, and the evolutionary future of our kind are now almost entirely within its grasp. Our government has obviously already fallen into its clutches, and we don't have a hell of a lot of time to stop its final triumph everywhere. Alarmist rhetoric, you say? We certainly hope so, because like Paul Revere, awakening you with alarm is our galloping intent. By land and by sea, and by our so-called public airwaves, too, corporate persons are upon us. We've suffered a literal corporate coup d'etat at the hands of these creatures, and life as we wish it depends on our learning their ways and weaknesses very, very fast. As Premila promised in our last show, we're going to introduce you to the logical monstrosity of corporate personhood from a wide variety of perspectives. Today we have scholars, theorists, artists, and activists from all across the country describing what corporate persons are, where they were born, and how to stop them from eating our world. First in line is soapbox virtuoso Kevin Danaher. Kevin's co-founder of Global Exchange, author of Corporations Are Gonna Get Your Mama, and a relentless warrior against the WTO, IMF, World Bank cabal. He gives us the fiery short course.
The myth that has been perpetrated on the American mind is that the corporation is equivalent, superior even, to a human being. And you have this whole long case history, how gradually corporations, using their money power and all their lawyers, have pushed case after case after case to get extended to them a legal fiction. Corporation has no physical existence. It's a bunch of people operating according to a set of rules, but it doesn't have a heart, a soul, you can't put it in jail, etc. And they have dragged and extended to them by penetration of government in the judicial process, they've extended to themselves a power that ascribes to them the status of human being, that they are a person. And you have First Amendment arguments that corporate donations to a politician are free speech, so you can't impede that. You have the unbelievable Supreme Court decision 1997 against people of Vermont who wanted to force the dairy industry to label bovine growth hormone milk, and and passed a law saying that, and the Supreme Court saying, oh no, well see, free speech includes the freedom not to speak, so corporations are free not to speak about whether or not they have bovine growth hormone in their milk. That's absolutely insane. By that logic, you could put poison in the food and you wouldn't have to tell the public because you have a right to not speak. I'm for full content labeling. All the social impact, what did the workers get paid, where was it made, how was it shipped, etc., and what was the environmental impact? And that should be a requirement of the company, full content labeling, so the consumer can know what was the impact of the production process. Because if you cut people off from knowing the impact of the production process, you got what we got now, the destruction of all biological systems. The whole system, the whole thing is in collapse, right? And we're actually threatened. Our existence as a species is being threatened. But in order to get at solving this, we have to deal with this issue of corporate personhood. Corporate personhood has to be taken away. And one way to do that that's been proposed is a constitutional amendment, which would take a big mass education campaign, 2/3 of the state legislatures. Corporation is not a human being. Simple, 7 words. That's the way Jim Hightower put it in one of his books. A corporation is not a human being. We can argue about the words. Corporation is not a person. Corporations do not have rights to rule over human beings. Human beings are supposed to rule over corporations. Whatever. And in fact, if you go back and you look at the history, this struggle existed early on. Thomas Jefferson said, we should crush in its birth the aristocracy of the moneyed corporations who already bid defiance to our government, right? That's like 1800, 1802, something like that, right? So already they were grabbing hold. Lincoln railed against it. Grover Cleveland, also Teddy Roosevelt, they all hit a similar message. Ike Eisenhower, 2-term, 8-year Republican president, he was the general who led our troops in World War II, and he said, beware of the military-industrial complex, the marriage of this militaristic empire-building military and the corporations that make money off it. That's massive. How can you possibly get at that? You take away the constitutional right of corporations to be treated as persons.
Now, if you found that torrent inspiring, but are still a little perplexed, allow us to offer a quick graduate seminar in corporate evolution, chaired by David Corton and Tom Hartman. David's the author of the movement Bible, When Corporations Rule the World, and founder of Yes Magazine, another prodigious source of good news in dark times. Tom's just published the definitive text on corporate personhood, entitled Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. This is a truly amazing book, full of startling history, contagious ideas, and appendix after appendix of shrewd tactics and solutions. David lives on the Pacific in northern Washington, and Tom resides in upstate Vermont. They've never met, but last week they agreed to a conference call to discuss the history and rise to power of the corporate fraternity, and kindly let us listen in.
The historical foundations of our current corporate dilemma trace back to the crown corporations in Europe, particularly the Dutch and the British, where the corporation was a form that was created to go out to exploit the people and resources and markets of colonies, and it was a very interesting alliance of state power, the power of the crown, and the power of private money, and the state granted the charter along with limited liability that allowed the organization of these massive concentrations of economic and sometimes even military power to go out and exploit colonial territories for the benefit of the crown. One of the things I must say I was particularly struck by in Tom's book is the story about the direct connection with Queen Elizabeth. In the case of the British East India Company, she was actually herself a private investor in the company, which meant that when she was granting the limited liability, she was in fact granting the granting herself limited liability on her own investment. The parallels to our present situation in the relationships between the current U.S. Administration and lawmaking on behalf of corporate interests, in which many of the of our top officials have personal interests, is too striking to ignore.
Yeah, I think one of the things also to consider when you're thinking about this is that in the very earliest forms, the corporate device was a means by which the ruling class could split off from itself a separate entity with limited liability that could go on these adventures, and if there was a disaster, the disaster wouldn't echo back to the ruling class. There was a clear definition or a limitation on the liability. It was also a way to bring the upper echelons of the ruled, the wealthy merchants and whatnot, in on the goodies that traditionally had been held in a tight fist through, say, through the Roman period and maybe the 8th through the 15th or 16th centuries in Europe, by the royal families of those groups. Oddly, now we see this position almost completely reversing itself here in the United States and the rest of the Western world, in particular, and all over the planet now broadly, although there are exceptions. That being that the creatures of the ruling class have amassed or aggregated to themselves so much wealth and power over the years that they now have turned and seized control of the governments. These governments being, in particular, the governments that were put into place by people hoping to govern themselves. And I find that just incredibly ironic.
Well, that's an interesting irony, although, it's very striking to me that when you're looking at a case of the Bushes and the Cheneys, this is more than institutional. You're seeing within real live individuals a bridging of personal economic interests with governmental power that also strikes me as quite new.
Although it's sort of moved in cycles in the United States. There was a period from just after the Civil War until until basically Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, when corporations had risen up and taken over the country. During the time in 1886 of that Supreme Court decision, four of the Supreme Court justices at that time were former railroad attorneys. There was a time when the corporations overtly ruled and packed the Senate, which led to the populist movement. And in 1912, as I recall, the elimination of the election of the Senate by the states and direct election of the Senate. And I think the important point is that whether it's new or not, we live in a country that proclaims its ideal to be a nation of the people, by the people, and for the people, government defined and controlled by, a government authorized by the people, governing by the consent of the governed, and that when commercial interests come in and usurp the functions of government to their benefit in detriment to those who are giving the consent, that is the governed, when corporations come in and change rules and regulations so that environmental protections are reduced, that enhance the profitability of corporations, but also diminish the health of the populace, for example, that's just simply a clear contradiction of the principles on which this country was founded, and to which even the most cynical of us still hold some hope for and belief in. And I think that's really the critical point here: is are we going to live in a democracy or not? And to the extent that it's being usurped and power has been seized and commercial interests and government are becoming intertwined, the most important question for me is what is that doing to democracy? How is that destroying or diminishing democracy?
Okay, well, let's ease into the general corporate background and the corporate domination of that particular time, and then what that did to the court in 1886.
Well, we have to go back to the Civil War that one of the issues of the Civil War was the Emancipation Proclamation and freeing the slaves. And after the Civil War, there were three amendments to the U.S. Constitution passed, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which essentially freed the slaves. They put into constitutional amendment form a law which had been earlier passed at the end of the Civil War by the legislatures, called the Civil Rights Act, which said that it was illegal to discriminate against people. It was, you know, you couldn't withhold due process of law from people, that people could vote regardless of race. Men, again, but nonetheless. And the railroads had become, as a consequence of the Civil War, probably the dominant economic force in the United States, the most powerful of the corporations. The only thing that kept them from completely overwhelming the government was the fact that there were several of them, and they were constantly fighting with each other as much as they were fighting with the government. But the challenge that the railroads put before the Supreme Court on numerous occasions, starting in the late 1870s, was that under the 14th Amendment, that the 14th Amendment says that due process shall not be denied any person. And they said, historically, corporations have been referred to at law as persons. They've been called artificial persons, and humans have been called natural persons, but they're both referred to as persons. And because this amendment doesn't say natural persons, therefore, it should be known that what we're really talking about here is corporations as well. They made this argument a number of times, and the Supreme Court rejected it flat out, explicitly, overtly rejected it. Said, sorry, not the case. The 14th Amendment was passed for the sole purpose of freeing the former slaves and giving them full rights. But there was one justice on the Supreme Court by the name of Stephen Field, who was also the judge of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California, and he traveled back and forth between Washington and California. And Field was of the opinion that corporations should be persons. Field was very much in the pockets of the railroads. He wrote in his diaries that he hoped that the railroads would sponsor his bid for the Republican nomination for president. And in the circuit court in California, he was constantly ruling that corporations were persons. And of course, these rulings would then get appealed to the Supreme Court, on which he also sat. So anyhow, the railroads kept bringing this back before the Supreme Court. And finally, in 1885, in arguments before the Supreme Court, Judge Sanderson, who was acting as an attorney, a former judge who is a railroad attorney, was arguing on behalf of the railroads. This was a tax case, and the case basically boiled down to whether Santa Clara County had the authority to tax fence posts along the right-of-way of the Southern Pacific Railroad, or whether those fence posts should be taxed by the state rather than the county. And Sanderson was arguing that the county didn't have the authority to make that kind of a distinction, because human people didn't have to pay that kind of tax on those kinds of fence posts, and so there was this unfair discrimination going on. And Delphin Delmas, who was the attorney for the County of Santa Clara, who was a Democrat and had single-handedly led the effort before the California legislature to spare the redwood forests in California successfully several years earlier, he argued before the Supreme Court that, number one, the fence post issue was the only issue that should be decided, which the court ultimately agreed with. And number two, that if we were to grant that corporations are persons on an equal footing at law with humans, we would put the quote organic laws of the state of California in a position ridiculous to the extreme, end quote. He said, we'll give you that a corporate person should have certain rights relative to another corporate person, and that a human person should have rights relative to another human person, but to put the two, a corporate person and a human person, in the same basket is to create an imbalance that's unimaginable. He was very eloquent in his argument. And the Supreme Court ruled that that the fence posts should have been taxed by the state, not by the county. And that was the end of that. And somewhere in the discussion before the court, the Chief Justice, Morris Remick Waite, had apparently said to the lawyers something to the effect of, you know, let's get on beyond this corporate personhood issue and talk about the fence posts. And he had phrased it somehow to, as if he had said something like, you know, we're not arguing here whether corporations are persons. We all know that they're persons. They're corporate persons. We all agree on that. Now get on with the fence post part. And after the decision had been made, which explicitly did not rule that corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment. In fact, in the decision itself, it says that the constitutional issues were not addressed. And in the headnote to the case, it says the constitutional issues were not addressed. And we found a personal correspondence in the National Archives between Morris Waite and his court reporter, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, in which Davis says to Waite, you know, I thought I heard you say corporations are persons. Did you say that? And Waite says, well, I leave it to you whether you're going to discuss that in your notes on the case, because the fact is that we didn't address the constitutional issue of whether corporations are persons. But Davis, for reasons that are still unknown to this day, in his commentary on the case, which doesn't have any legal authority, in fact, there was a Supreme Court case in 1905 in which the Supreme Court explicitly ruled that headnotes had no legal standing. Davis put into the, you know, opened the headnotes, that is the commentary that precedes the ruling, with the statement that corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment. And what has happened since then is that subsequent courts and attorneys have read the headnotes and not read the decision and cited that case as precedent and said, in 1886, the court established that corporations are persons equal to humans under the 14th Amendment, and therefore all other provisions of the Bill of Rights. Therefore, they should have the constitutional right of free speech. Therefore, they should have the constitutional right of privacy. Therefore, they should have the constitutional right against takings and against double jeopardy and against discrimination. And so what has come out of that is that, you know, the against discrimination part of the JCPenney chain in the 1920s, as I recall, sued the state of Florida for a law that they had which placed a higher tax on out-of-state chain stores than it did on local stores, saying that that was unfair discrimination. And that's established, you know, nearly a century of precedent that local communities, by and large, can't keep out corporations that they don't want in their community. And with regard to privacy, Dow Chemical sued the EPA because the EPA had information that one of Dow's plants was emitting toxins at a level that was not allowed for by law, and Dow wouldn't let them come in and do an inspection. So the EPA hired a pilot in a little private plane, and they flew it over the top, you know, about 1,000 feet or so above the top of this factory, and sampled the air. And, you know, found that they were emitting this stuff and went after them. And Dow sued and took it all the way to the Supreme Court and said, hey, they invaded our Fourth Amendment rights of privacy. And the court, looking back at the Santa Clara case, said, well, yeah, I guess they've got constitutional rights, they have a right to privacy. And so now OSHA and EPA can't do surprise inspections. And, you know, the First Amendment is probably the most egregious. Corporations claiming the First Amendment right of free speech, and then the court also determined that money equals speech, and so corporations were able to insert themselves into the political process to the point that they've largely usurped it now.
You know, where this becomes totally perverse is in the fact that these artificial legal entities, of course, have the largest of them has so much more power than any real living individual. You know, I'm very struck by a cartoon that's been widely circulated with it showing a, you know, a corporation with this you know, huge electronic power system shouting out its message as the corporate controlled media, and you know, the citizens down below trying to get out their message with a little, unpowered megaphone. And the corporate guy saying, you know, isn't it great that we both have free speech? You know, the corporation doesn't die, so it has the ability to acquire property and power without limit. It has the ability to hire massive teams of lawyers if they're an individual is in a lawsuit with a corporation. So as soon as you give corporations equal rights with natural persons, it turns out that the playing field becomes so unlevel in terms of the amount of economic and political power that pretty soon you find that that individuals have very little voice compared to the ability of the corporate system to drown them out, to outbid them in the political system, and to outshout them in the public arena.
Huh?
Amen.
Okay.
Oh, one thing I'd add to that is there are other ways in which corporations are different from natural persons, and that compound the absurdity of this. Not only can corporations live forever, but they can tear off a metaphorical arm or leg and turn it into a new person, a new corporation, in a day, fully formed and fully born. They can change their citizenship, as Tyco International Corporation did from the United States to Bermuda, in a day. If I accumulate wealth when I die, if I want to pass that along to members of my family, it will be taxed. Corporations don't die, so that never happens. They can accumulate infinitely forever. There are ways that corporations can shelter income from taxes that are not available to individuals, which further allows them to accumulate wealth, which equals power in this country. Corporations don't need to breathe fresh air, they don't need to drink pure water, and they don't need to eat uncontaminated food. They do, however, have one prime directive, sort of like the Asimov's robots of old, and that is to generate profit. And so the single moral compass, you could almost call it a biological imperative or urge that a corporation has, is to generate profit. And that, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's why we created corporations in the first place. But to say that an entity whose sole purpose is to create profit should be entrusted with the means or given the ability to destroy the means by which natural persons, human beings like you and I, keep our biological systems alive, the purity of the air, the purity of our water, the purity of our food, the quality of our lives, is outrageous. I don't think anybody can rationally dispute this. History tells us that corporations will and have many, many times subordinated the interests of human beings to the interests of profit. And therefore, they really should be in a separate category at law, as they were in this country until 1886, viewed as artificial entities and not given access to the Bill of Rights and the amendments to the Constitution designed to free the slaves.
Now, if you begin to organize an economy around human-scale enterprises that are owned by real people who have a real stake in them and who bear full responsibility for the decisions made regarding those assets, you have effectively eliminated the institutional form of the publicly traded limited liability corporation, and you have removed a cancer from society, an institutional cancer, a pathological institutional form that is actually programmed to behave as a cancer or as a sociopath. And this to me is the direction in which we ultimately need to move if we are to create societies that are truly democratic, that function for the long-term interests of people, community, and nature. So it is a structural reform that to me is every bit as important as the earlier reforms our ancestors put in place to eliminate the institutions of monarchy. In a sense, the corporation survives as a relic of monarchy, and we simply haven't finished the project of of democratizing our institutions, and this is the current challenge.
For those who forgot your notebooks or prefer the classic comic book approach, the San Francisco Mime Troupe offers a slightly more succinct rendition of corporate history.
Some have said it is the bastard offspring of the legendary feudal bloodsucker. But I believe it was created when corporations were declared legal people.
Legal people?
It was 1886, a little-known land use case here in California. Lawyers for Southern Pacific Railroad argued that the 14th Amendment, which declared slaves free and equal citizens, should be extended to corporations.
Corporations?
Yes. A superior court judge agreed, and corporations became legal people with many of the rights of you or I, yet they are immortal.
Immortal?
They feed on tax breaks, bailouts, and the privatization of public wealth. And in the last few months, their power seems to be growing.
Professor, this is preposterous.
More preposterous than corporations running welfare systems.
Oh, well, I never said
that. Tax breaks for billion-dollar companies, while social services crumble. No human would create such horrors. Only the inhuman mind of the bloodsucker.
We realize that most listeners have probably never heard of corporate personhood before, and that this is a lot of strangeness to digest in one sitting. But we hope that a serious minority of you are starting to grasp the clear and present danger this lunacy presents to our country and our lives. The residents of the small town of Point Arena, California, began to sense the madness nearly 2 years ago, and became the first community ever to strike out against it. When our counter-coup is won and the post-corporate historians look back at our times, Point Arena will likely be viewed in the same bright light as Lexington, another defiant village that fired a shot heard round the world. We spoke to one of their people's militia recently over a rather primitive phone line. Hey, we said we'd take you to the frontiers of democracy. We didn't promise first class.
We're talking with Jan Edwards, who helped spearhead one of the first movements in America, and perhaps the world, against the concept of corporate personhood. Tell us why it has so riled the residents of Point Arena.
Corporate personhood, the way that we explain it, is when corporations have rights in the Constitution that are usually reserved for human, like Bill of Rights, 14th Amendment, like civil rights legislation. Corporations having these rights has really heavily affected our ability to run our democracy and to rule over corporations. Basically, the Constitution says that people rule. And if corporations are to be considered people, then corporations rule. What they're ruling over, according to the Constitution, is the government. So now we have corporations ruling over the government. It wasn't always so, but that's the situation now. And it's affecting our lives in many ways. For example, it is the reason that corporations can give unlimited money to campaigns, because they're people. And courts have said that money is speech, and you can't limit the free speech of a person. And since corporations are persons and money is speech, then corporations can give money for political reasons.
So why Point Arena? What got this started there?
We were a small Alliance for Democracy chapter. When we started looking at campaign finance reform, I think it was 1999, and we were also beginning to get worried about the things with the World Trade Organization. That was the year of the Seattle marches. But the more that we looked at campaign finance reform and the more that we looked at the way that corporations were ruling things, we realized that the reason that we couldn't take away this right of corporations to give money into our political process was because they were considered persons under the Constitution by the Supreme Court. It wasn't by changing the Constitution. They just interpreted the word person in the 14th Amendment to mean corporation as well as person. We began to feel that that was really the core of the issue. If we didn't get at that core, we were not going to be able to change things. We began to look at how, in a small town, one would begin this battle, and we wrote a resolution, and we presented it to the city council of Point Arena. The resolution didn't have any binding effect, and it isn't law. We still had to make our case to the community there were incredible letter fights, and we had a lot of disagreement in the community and explaining to do. But at the end of the day, our city council voted 4-1 to pass this resolution that they did not agree with this Supreme Court decision of 100 years ago. The people who seemed to understand it instinctively were just the average person who hadn't put a lot of study into these things. Also, we did have a lot of lawyers who jumped on board and said, yes, this has been a problem for some time. You know, you might think it would be a right-left issue, but it really wasn't. People who were invested in thinking of corporations as persons for whatever reason, they had trouble thinking of this. And also, people who didn't take the time to think it through and who jumped to the conclusion that we were talking about something else, like limited liability, which is not a personhood right. It's like a charter privilege. Other people thought we were talking about corporate right to sue and be sued. We had to spend a lot of time sorting out what the confusions were, and it was a new idea for folks. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is a group that has taken on an abolished corporate personhood campaign, and so we've been thinking of ways to say it almost, you know, in a T-shirt or bumper sticker way. And we take our inspiration from the abolitionists. We don't believe this corporate personhood wrong is something that can be modified or regulated, just like the abolitionists did not believe slavery could be modified or regulated. It had to be done away with completely because it was completely wrong thinking. That is the way we're approaching this issue. The slave owners were not asked by the abolitionists to create a voluntary code of conduct. We didn't set up a regulatory agency for slavery. Abolitionists just went ahead and said, no, whole thing's got to go. Whole thing has got to be redefined. The slave that was defined as property was now, by the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, defined as a person. So we have a little phrase that we have on our T-shirts that says, slavery is the legal fiction that a person is property. Corporate personhood is the legal fiction that property is a person. Sometimes we just talk about that a little bit with people because they can understand that slavery is a legal fiction. And it's the same way with corporate personhood. It's not real in the way that gravity is real. Slavery was very real to the slaves, don't get me wrong, but it was only real because the law said it was real. And the same thing is true about corporate personhood. Corporate personhood only exists because the Supreme Court has said it did, not because it has any real validity in nature.
Supposing corporate personhood was revoked across the land, how would American society change?
Well, the day after slaves were freed, what had happened was that there was a power shift. Now things were possible that hadn't been possible before. They could begin to express themselves in new ways. That is kind of what would happen if we abolished corporate personhood. We would still have a lot of work to do, but a huge barrier would have been removed from our way to do these things. We would have a power shift. The people would once again be in control of the government, and corporations would be subservient to the people, which is how they started out. If you wanted some actual examples of what might be vulnerable to change if we abolished corporate personhood, I think one place to start looking would be that we could prohibit all political activity by corporations, all political donations, and all corporate lobbying. They are currently legal because corporate persons are protected under the First Amendment, and this is called free speech. The Fourth Amendment is another issue, this Arthur Anderson stuff. A lot of this stuff of not being allowed to look at the books, that has to do with the Fourth Amendment right of corporations to be protected from search and seizure without a warrant. Removing that Fourth Amendment would also help the EPA and OSHA come in for inspections whenever they wanted. They wouldn't have to set up a schedule or get a warrant. Those would be some of the areas I would go into. Also, the Takings Clause is a part of the Fifth Amendment, which, of course, is part of our Bill of Rights, which says that the government cannot take property from a person without just compensation. The corporations have used this for about 100 years now to either overturn regulation that is passed by the states or to make everybody pay a lot of money to protect the environment and the workers. Everything is a takings now, and that's kind of what we're looking at NAFTA. NAFTA is sort of an extension of the Fifth Amendment Takings Clause, which corporations only have because they're persons. Many, many problems with corporations stem back to this personhood decision.
This is indeed revolutionary. I mean, it's one of the first movements that's addressing the fundamental powers of corporations rather than their specific activities.
Yes, we're looking at what they are, not what they do. What we've been doing with the Women's International League is traveling around and talking with folks about this. We have 3 short-term goals: to get more towns and cities to adopt resolutions similar to the one that we did in Point Arena. The second goal is to change the ACLU's position on this issue. They are siding with the Supreme Court with corporations being persons. And our third goal is to insert this issue into the upcoming election. To that end, we've got some things on the ground. One is that we expect the city of San Francisco to be looking at trying to pass such a resolution very soon. The citizens are beginning to support this. We have a supervisor who has signed up, and he's going to be writing a resolution and presenting it, we hope, to San Francisco City Board of Supervisors. That would be a very big city compared to Point Arena to have passed such a thing. There's things happening also in Pennsylvania and in Arizona, and I think in Maine too, right?
There is a ferment, yes.
Power to the person.
The Arizona initiative Jan spoke of is perhaps the most ambitious to date, and envisions a plebiscite to abolish corporate personhood throughout the state. We might remember here that over a century ago, it was the populist farmers of Arizona who first introduced the initiative and referendum system to America as an antidote to the railroad corporations who had bribed their statehouse politicians deaf, dumb, and blind. Last week, we talked to one of the state's neo-populist leaders over an equally atrocious phone line, and he tells us here what they have in mind.
We're talking with Brian Lane, who's helping the Arizona Greens address the issue of corporate personhood in Arizona.
As we see it, corporate personhood is really the legal cornerstone that allows large corporations to take dominion of our government, democracy, and the people. Regulatory law was a system set up by the corporations to restrict public input. The corporations blame their economic ills on government regulations, while the public blames the regulatory agencies for not controlling the corporations. So attention is deflected from the corporations as a source of the problem and towards reform of the regulatory agencies. Regulatory law has never worked, and we have to begin to address the defining laws, such as corporate personhood, if we ever hope to regain governance. And abolishing corporate personhood would be to take back the rights of the average American to govern themselves without the undue influence of the money that corporations use to corrupt the system. With the Arizona Green Party, it is considered a premier issue. Right now, there are proposals for one local green group and the Arizona Green Party. The propositions basically would start on a plan. So we start by educating one community. Then we'll begin to campaign for a state ballot initiative, which would educate more people statewide while pursuing real change in the Arizona state constitution. And soon after that, we plan on going national. We bring it to the national spotlight. There are currently several groups on the local and national level that are working on the issue. We have to combine our efforts. We're just beginning to do that. The Arizona Green Party is beginning to align itself with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and other locals to really push this. It has to be a grassroots effort to succeed. The media power and monetary influence that the corporations will initiate to stop this movement must be overwhelmed, really, by public concern. And we imagine that we'll burn a lot of shoe leather and we'll have to be very creative.
Are the state constitutions the linchpin for this power?
It really isn't state constitution. It really has to be the U.S. Constitution that we have to go after.
When you talk to people, do you find that there's any natural division of opinion, like liberal Democrats would be for this and conservative Republicans would be against it? Or does it fall outside that box?
Once you explain it, and it doesn't really take that long, most people agree. They understand that corporations have control of our government.
Who do you see as your natural allies nationally?
The POCLAD people have been very good for information. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom have been great. So have Redwood Coast Alliance for Democracy, the Alliance for Democracy, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. A lot of organizations that have different tangents into corporate personhood issue, and they seem to be coming together now. We've spoken with Bill Myers and Jan Edwards, and we've done some strategic planning with them, but we're not sure once it really gains national spotlight how it will be attacked, but it will be, without a doubt. We've seen some of the statements by the ACLU, and we're not sure why they've taken that stance. As a matter of fact, I was still going to reach out to the Arizona Civil Liberties Union and just sit down and talk to them and see what we might be able to work out.
What's the next step for you?
Basically, the local ordinance first, and then the state ballot initiative after that.
And how do you see the personhood movement fitting into the overall growth of the movement nationwide?
It seems to me that corporate personhood is the hinge pin. It is the part of judge-made democracy that has given all the power to the corporations. The Green Party has its 10 key values, and I don't see any of those values that corporations have not usurped. They've taken all our rights in all those areas.
So this should be a pretty unifying force.
It should allow the restoration of labor unions. It should allow regulatory agents to inspect corporate property at will and not at the scheduled convenience of corporate management. So it should begin to restore democracy, not democracy mandated by the corporations who would allow us only the freedom to decide what fashion to wear or which car to drive or what flavor of the month we want to consume.
Most of the activity on this issue has been coming from the hinterlands. Arizona, Point Arena, there's eruptions going on up in Maine. Do you have anything for the urban cousins to sort of get them on the same page with this?
We have to fight for justice and democracy in our communities that are being destroyed by low-paying chain stores. Here in Arizona, local ranchers lose while six corporations control 80% of the beef industry. The local farmers lose since four corporations now control 60% of national flour production. The citizens lose because only six corporations control opinion because they own 90% of the informational media. And corporations don't care about the people. Their only concern is profit maximization and putting any financial burden that they can onto the people, and usually without their knowing it. And we think it's wrong any way you look at it. All the assumptions that have been made and used in economic models that the corporations have been marketing to the public are proving that it's not working. The foundation of that belief is that unlimited growth will benefit everyone. To accept the reality of physical limits, just resource limits, would force them to realign their economic models to examine equity and not growth. Of course, corporate CEOs didn't jump their own pay 600% in the last 20 years, while average workers' pay is flatlined by making the system equitable. We can't see the economic model working.
And in grand summation, neither can Kevin Danaher.
We need to come together as a people and take back our government from the corporations, take back our university system from the corporations, and take back the public airwaves from the corporations. And there's two basic routes to do that. One is politico-legal, getting amendments, ordinances, etc., to constitutional law. And the other is economically, by boycotting their goods, by getting out the information about their sweatshops, by putting our bodies out in the street, buying shares in their meetings and going into their meetings and raising these issues in their shareholder meetings. There's all sorts of techniques. What we need to do in the movement is not get into tactical sectarianism, arguing with each other, oh, I do demonstrations and you do shareholder resolutions, you're not as radical as I am. No. We need many, many different tactical fronts, but we need to coordinate that. We want the butterflies to fly in formation. We need to start thinking about how powerful we are. We, the people, we have the power to change all this when we come together and unite. Corporations understand this. That's why they have Chamber of Commerce and all these National Manufacturers Association. We need to unite. We need to get the fingers into a fist.
So, gang, whose power is it going to be? Ours or theirs? It's a real question, you know. We get uppity. They are bound to react.
You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, and I won't have it! Is that clear? You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There are no third worlds. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems. One vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational dominion of dollars. Petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars, Reichmarks, rims, rubles, pounds, and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines
the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone.
Am I getting through to you?
You get up and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business. It has been since man crawled out of the slime. And our children will live to see that perfect world in which there's no war or famine, oppression or brutality. One vast and ecumenical holy company, whom all men serve, in which all men will hold a share of stock. All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Just think about the power and the money. Come be smart, come be rational. The future belongs to the transnational. Better to win than be beaten. Better to eat than be eaten. Don't resist us, don't even try. Come on over to the winning side.
While you're making up your mind, we'd like to thank all our valiant guests and direct your attention to www.bigmed.org for a complete listing of their websites and an archive of this show. To preview Tom Hartman's book and many great personhood links, see www.unequalprotection.org. All our music today was courtesy of the oddly outspoken San Francisco Mime Troupe. You can and should order their wildly seditious CD at www.sfmt.org. And from all the gang at the Ain't That Good News Collective, thanks for listening. And remember, friends don't let friends terminally incorporate. Stay free, stay alarmed. We'll keep you posted on this war.